Prem, do you see true digital journalism happening in India at all?
I know this sounds kind of rude and you don't want to generalize, but the short answer is no. What we still have is stories that still follow the print template, lots of words with maybe an image stuck here and there to as a sort of nod to multimedia, and maybe a small video stuck in there somewhere and put out saying this is multimedia journalism or digital journalism. It isn't.
Then what is truly online and digital news media? Prem Panikkar joins us on the Pragati podcast today to talk about his journey in building online news sites at Rediff and Yahoo in the 90s, 2000s and 2010s. And Prem shares his thoughts on how to do this right. How here in India we can imagine and build a world-class independent online news media house in 2020. Hi and welcome to the Pragati podcast. I'm Pavan Srinath. I'm here with Prem Panikkar, who joins me online. We are recording on Zencaster today, and we are going to be talking about how to really reimagine digital journalism in India.
Thanks for having me on the show.
We are seeing the crisis unfold all around us. We're seeing how Indian news media is in deep trouble. The crisis has been there for a long time, and perhaps the lockdown and the pandemic were the last nails in that. And Prem, you have been at this for longer than most. You have been innovating on digital and internet-first journalism for a very long time, starting with Rediff in, I think, the end of 95 and early 96. So before we get to what's happening today, the mistakes and the problems that are there with Indian print-first journalism, I want to go back to that time when it was the early days of the internet. There was a lot of optimism, and there was a lot of really, really cool cutting edge things that were happening. And a lot of it happened at Rediff as well out of India. So Prem, can you take us back and tell us how you thought about online journalism back then?
Yeah, to go back in time, we got together as a team sometime late September, early October of 95, which is when Ajit Balakrishnan got a group of us together and said, let's do something on the internet. The thing is that we were flying without instruments. When I joined, I'd never seen what this internet was about, even in its then vestigial stages. In fact, the first time I saw the internet in operation was about a week or so after I had joined, and that was pretty much true of my five or six colleagues at that time.
Wow.
It's also worth remembering that Rediff on the Net, as it was then called, when it was launched, it was the first web-only news site in the world. Pretty much everything else was legacy media with an internet presence. And this is important because typically when you move from a newspaper to another newspaper, you're hired to sort of a newspaper is failing and you're hired to do something about it. You've got tons and tons of examples from legacy media around the world. And you can pick up best ideas, you can tune them to your own existing conditions, the paper you're working with and stuff. So there are templates that you can use, you can improve on. But when you're doing something for the first time, there is nothing, right? I mean, there is no example for you to follow. The nice thing about that is because we didn't know any examples, you also didn't know what failure was like.
So flying in blind feels like a luxury right now, right? Which is rarely afforded to most people trying something new.
Yeah, exactly. And the nice thing was that the sky was the limit. You thought of something, you did it, you failed, that was okay because you learned from that and you moved on and there wasn't much of a price for that failure. The other thing was that we weren't really hampered by having to think within frames. Industries defined rules for themselves, best practices, all of that. None of that existed. So when we got together and said, okay, what is it we're doing? Yeah, sure, we're doing something on the internet, but what? And the only thing we had to go by was the basic principles of journalism, which is report what is actually news, stick with the facts, get it out quick and clean, then keep iterating as new information came in, which is the advantage of the internet, right?
Right.
And that was the first thing that we leveraged, the fact that you could go back and change a report or add to a report. We said, keep your opinions out of news stories, for instance. Keep it tight, except, of course, those maths reports that I wrote, which went on forever, 2,500, 3,000 words.
Okay.
So what we did was we used the templates of classic journalism and applied it to the syntax of the internet.
Okay. So instead of a static article, you could have it get updates over time. Correct. So that was one small but extremely essential and important tweak that used the internet.
Correct. The other nice thing was that we had a very clear idea of who our audience was. There weren't too many internet connections in India, maybe about 400, 500 at the time.
Okay.
Our entire audience was abroad. So we could ask ourselves, okay, what would this audience want? These are people who, if they want to know what's happening about India, you go to the nearest Patel Brothers and buy a newspaper, which by then is 3 days old. It's been shipped from India. So what people want, and it's not just Indians, it is anybody interested in India, what they wanted was what exactly is going on in India at this point. So that gave us our statement of intent. The basics of journalism gave us our working principles. And that was the base we built on.
Okay.
And the thing was that because it was a small, tight team, the turnaround time from thinking of something, we were hugely responsive to audience needs. There's a classic example. For instance, we soft launched in December. The hard launch was in January. February 14th was the 1996 World Cup.
Right.
I was doing match reports. One of the things that Ajit Balakrishnan had done was he had sent the Rediff link out to many Indian American groups, you know, student groups in Harvard and Yale and MIT and all of that, and then community groups and stuff, and said, please send us feedback. So when we started covering the World Cup, after about 4 or 5 days, there was this bunch from Harvard who wrote in and said, look, we love the match reports. It's like actually watching the matches. But the problem is that matches are taking place in India time, which is night for us. And until we wake up the next day, we have no means of knowing what's happened. Mm. So can you do a halfway report during the lunch break? So that at least we read that and then go to sleep and then wake up again and see what finally happened.
Okay.
So we said, fine, I mean, we can do that. And from next day, we had, during the lunch hour, there was a report. And then there was a final report at the end of the match. 3-4 days after that, we got another mail from the same group. And they said, is it actually possible, you know, once every hour to put a little, you know, one paragraph or so?
Okay.
AB read that mail out to us. And I was kind of exasperated. I said, at this rate, these guys are going to ask for an update every minute. The fun was that there was this young techie who was sitting there. We were all in one room, right? So everybody heard everybody else's conversations. There was no CEO's cabin and meeting room and all of that stuff.
Right.
So this guy heard what I said, and he suddenly looked up and said, hey, you know what? I can make you a text box and you can type into that and it'll go up in real time.
Okay.
So we looked at each other and said, okay, I mean, try it. Next morning, the text box was ready. And the day after that was an India game. So we announced that we were going live. We had no idea what it meant. Frankly, I had no idea what it meant because 8 hours, 100 overs, 6 balls an over, that is 600 balls you're describing in 25, 30 words. That's a hell of a lot of typing to do.
Yeah.
In real time without being able to marinate it and find the right words and stuff. We just never thought of the consequences, which goes back to what I was saying about fearing failure. We never feared that failure. We just did it. And what happened was, firstly, people loved it. Secondly, everything crashed. Yeah, I mean, we didn't realize what kind of traffic was coming our way. So there was a time when I got locked out of. And you have to remember that during those days, your internet window, you didn't have multiple tabs and stuff.
Yeah.
So when you typed into a box and hit send, and if the connection was slow, which it invariably was, that just stood there. This thing went round and round and round. And meanwhile, two other balls had been delivered and you couldn't type that.
Okay.
So you had to type it somewhere else or write it somewhere else. And when this went, you had it was just you making it up as we went along, but it worked.
Right.
And almost everything that I remember us doing in the early days of the internet came of casual conversations. There was this conversation of people that just sitting around talking about, you know, how people are tribal. We like to make connections.
Hmm.
And Ajit Balakrishnan was, you know, that's a good idea. Let's make connections. And we started something called Connections, spelled with an X, which was Facebook before there was Facebook. Basically, you formed peer groups, work groups, or family groups, or whatever, and you connected with each other and you kept exchanging messages and stuff.
Wow.
So it was about being agile, being nimble, being responsive to audience needs. I remember Rediff was the first to go to give mail unlimited storage. We literally forced everybody else to do it.
And what you're describing with the ball-by-ball commentary is now par for the course on Cricinfo or any other cricket or other websites, right? I mean, you get an update with every ball real time. And even if you're in office, in a commute, you don't want to listen to anything, you can do a text play-by-play watch. So now it's an industry standard, but it was something, before something becomes an industry standard, somebody has to innovate it first, right?
Correct. And innovation largely stems from, you know, from being incredibly tuned to what the audience is telling you. Even the commentary was a classic example. There was actually a group from Harvard that visited Rediff. This was after the World Cup. They had just come on some kind of study tour, so they wanted to visit Rediff as well. And they were sitting with Ajit Balakrishnan and talking. And we were asking them, look, I mean, how in the hell do you guys manage this? 8 hours, you're just sitting staring at a computer screen waiting for text to come in. And they said, it's like being at the stadium. We get to know what's going on. Yeah, but what do you do in the meantime?
Right.
And they said, we chat with each other about what's going on. Was that the right bowling change? Whatever it is. And somewhere the penny dropped and we said, what if we added a chat box to the side?
Okay.
So we split the screen into, the left was ball-by-ball commentary. The right was a chat room where people could enter and talk to each other.
Okay.
And that became the next stage of the thing, right? So they could talk to each other. They could talk to me. They could disagree. They could do whatever. And occasionally I would go to the right and respond to them. So suddenly you built in interactivity. And we didn't have all these words. We didn't think, oh, let's make this interactive. We just said, how do we keep these guys occupied while this is going on? And we just did what seemed natural. I think that is the one thing that we learned from the Rediff experience, that the internet forces you to be incredibly nimble and also incredibly responsive. If your audience is telling you something, you listen to them and you work with that feedback or you die.
Right. And so from these sort of early days, right, so where you were essentially, your first audience was Indians living abroad who had access to the internet and wanted to find out about what's happening in India,
mm-hmm.
with Indian sports, Indian politics, Indian news in general. I mean, once we start entering to the 2000s, right, where suddenly from 500 internet connections and computers in India, you go to maybe tens of thousands, maybe a couple of lakhs. How did you see the space evolving?
Well, I mean, in the first place, we saw it as an opportunity, not a problem, because the audience was expanding, right? And
right.
The larger your audience, the better for you. The second thing was that we realized that, okay, who's this Indian and when is he going to connect? And those early days, it was mostly from the office.
Right.
So we were looking at an Indian in India who was, you know, traveling to work. He would have probably read the newspaper, maybe saw the early morning news bulletin on TV, whatever. So he was kind of up to speed with what had happened while he was asleep. And then he got to the office and he needed to know what was happening right now. So live news became the big draw. And we had to keep in mind two things. One is, for the Indian in India, we had to go beyond what was in the newspapers.
Right.
The morning newspapers. So repeating anything that was already there was a complete no-no. But we also had to remember to keep an eye on the clock, because when the U.S. audience kicks in, and that was the second biggest catchment area. I mean, it was the biggest catchment area at that time, but it was the alternate catchment area. When the U.S. audience kicked in, they couldn't come into the middle of a live report.
Right.
Because they were sleeping. So they needed to catch up and then follow along, right? So during that period, we had to aim for that period and say, okay, U.S. guys are going to be waking up and logging in around now, so we need summaries. We need to give them a rapid way of finding out what happened since the last time they logged in. So it was just tweaking things so that you also followed the time clock and adjusted for who the bulk of your audience at any given point in time was. Morning, it was the Indian audience. Evening, it was the... It's not that the US guys didn't log in late evening their time or early morning our time, but you had to focus on the majority audience. So effectively, it was keeping an eye on how the ecosystem was evolving, how the audience was, where the audience was coming from, and adapting to that in pretty much real time.
And keeping your unique value proposition valid,
yeah.
Right? I mean, like, so here you were online, so you were going to go beyond what would be there in a broadsheet. You'd be able to give news now rather than have people wait for the, I don't know, the evening news on TV or the morning paper the next day.
Precisely. I mean, we were very clear that our mission statement remained the same. It was India now. And it was news-driven. Any opinion, analysis, etc., played off of the news in order to help you understand things better. But the underlying mission statement was what is going on in India right now. We had this thing of saying that, look, if we have to bring it to a point where if something somebody hears that something is happening, they come to read. If they don't see it there, then it didn't happen.
Okay. So there was also that aim that you have to cover all the important stories. Yeah. Missing them is not an option.
It wasn't an option, no.
So in all this, can you tell us a little bit about the kind of team and resources that were needed to this? I mean, you obviously needed very dedicated and motivated people who were willing to adapt on the fly. But beyond that, what did you need to make this happen?
Well, I think it was basically two things. One was, before I joined Rediff, for instance, I'd worked as a feature writer, I'd worked as a features editor, and as senior editor in charge of a weekly magazine. So I thought that I had about 6 years' experience. What I learned when I stepped into Rediff for the first time was that I didn't have a single day's experience, because everything that I had learned before, except probably how to report news, none of it was valid anymore, right? I was working in an entirely different environment with its own rules and its own ecosystem. So that was the first thing that everybody who joined had to wrap their heads around, that everything that we had learned till date was outdated and we had to reinvent ourselves and our ways of working. As for the strength of the team, we were very sure that, so in news itself, there is quotidian news. It's just things that keep happening. And what we realized was we had the option of either putting people in every city and every state in the country, or being a very lean but very smart team. So the first thing we built to industry standard was our desk.
Okay.
The desk was capable of going through the agency feeds, collecting the latest news that was worth publishing, and then making a quick call on, do you publish the agency report per se, or do you add to it?
Right.
And if you add to it, you did it at the desk.
Okay.
On top of that, you had the reporting team, which was focused purely on what are the stories that require additional reporting. So a press conference for us may have been a story if it was important, but it was not important enough for us to send a reporter, because agencies are covering it anyway. Whatever is said in the press conference, you're going to get. Why waste a resource on that? So the reporter's job was to do the things that the agencies were not doing.
So you maintained your comparative advantage there and deployed resources very, very sparingly, right?
Yeah, we maximized resources to ensure that we stayed with our core competence of news going up rapidly. And then we added the bells and whistles to it, the special reporters and say, for instance, the cricket reporting team. Which obviously was not just agency-driven copy, right? There was me and Faisal and Ashish Makotra, and all of us were doing match reports and live stuff. And the same thing with politics, for instance. We had a team of analysts. We had reporters like Sheena Butt, for instance, reporting out of Delhi. There were reporters in the major business, was the same thing. It was all desk-driven, really. So when you do that, you're not looking at hundreds of people. You're literally looking at, I think at our peak, we were about a little over four dozen people.
Wow. That's still a very, very small team.
Yeah, it is. And I believe that for any news organization, the desk is the most important. It is the least, it is the area that most legacy media houses pay the least attention to, but a strong desk is a brilliant use of resources.
Okay. I want to talk about the desk. I want to talk about also what you mentioned earlier about what's working and what's not and taking feedback, right? So one part of all of this is, I think in the 2000s, the tech for numbers also increased quite a bit, right? So you could track analytics, you could get richer analytics on how people were engaging with your content or reading or viewing. And with that explosion, I'm sure you could also use it better, but it's also easy to get lost in that, right? So how do you see this change when in the 2000s our focus on numbers, views, even now we talk about either revenue focused media or, you know, numbers and views focused media. Can you unpack that a little for us?
In the 2000s, you did have data and you used it to make sure that, you know, you weren't slipping, that your audience was still with you, that it was growing and stuff like that. But you weren't as Excel sheet driven as you started becoming, say, towards the latter part of the 2000s.
Okay.
And the thing about data is there and there is deep data. It depends on what you're using it for. But the classic example, I think, was the early days of Yahoo, for instance, which I joined in January of 2010.
Okay.
The MD at the time was Arun Tadanki, and we went through a round of interviews and face-to-face meetings and stuff like that. And I remember once I had made the decision to join, one of the questions I had for Arun was, okay, what do you want from editorial? Yahoo at that time really didn't have much of an editorial. There were a lot of people, but there was no focus.
Okay.
So the first thing that Arun did was he broke down the numbers. He said, look, at this point in time, we have 24 million unique users and we're doing 175 million page views. This is in a month on media properties.
Okay.
And he said, if we can get to 500 million, we've got critical mass, and critical mass from the point of view of selling.
Okay.
Right. I mean, he said, I can go to market with that. Then we sat, when once I joined for about 2 months, all I was doing was looking at data. I was looking at, you know, how many people come in on a given day, how many repeat visitors, how many pages does an average person consume during each visit, all of those, and also where they're coming from and where they're leaving. And one of the things that jumped out at us at that point was we realized that a lot of people were coming in directly onto a story page. By then, if you remember, social media was in its infancy, really.
Right.
But people had already started by 2010 and all that. People were finding links on their favorite social media sites and logging in or coming into your site through a random link.
And so the value of the homepage itself started diminishing slowly, right?
Exactly. And we saw that trend happening. So one of the things that we said was you need to then treat your story page as a homepage.
Right.
You do tell the story right up front. But having done that, you also need to give readers the opportunity to discover other good stuff, which you would otherwise have found on the homepage, but you're not doing it. Also, the thing you have to remember is if you click on a link and come to the site, the back button does not take you to the homepage, right?
Yeah, it doesn't.
So that process of discovery was no longer viable. Therefore, you had to find alternatives. So then we worked with tech to say, how do we re-engineer our homepage so that discovery goes hand in hand with reading? And the example that we used was that of how you structure a shopping mall, for instance. Look, the shopping mall has got two different kinds of customers coming in, right? I go there to, say, 1MG Road. I know Food Hall is there and I want certain vegetables that I wouldn't otherwise get, or some sauces or whatever. I'm going straight to Food Hall, buying it, I'm coming back. And then there's the other random walk-in kind of thing, which is the majority. Now, you go to most malls and you realize that if you go from you take the escalator from the ground floor to the first floor, the escalator from first to second is not immediately adjacent. You actually have to walk a semicircle past all the shops before you get to the next one. The reason why being, as you're walking, you see these shop fronts and there are the display windows and you get tempted by something or the other. So we figured that that was the paradigm that we would use in designing our site, random discovery. And the outcome was that in November of that same year, 2010, we touched 1 billion page views, which is double what our own one. It was just technological tweaks. One of the things we said was we will not allow an algorithm to determine what the reader should read next. The editors will determine, so that we can put the best content in front of you at the most appropriate time. And having done that, having optimized the Yahoo pages for discovery, we said, okay, we need a USP. And that is when we launched Yahoo Originals. The thing with most websites is there has to be approximate reason for you to log in. I mean, back in the day, you had 10 websites that you visited. Today, my morning visit list in the morning tab is about 30.
Okay.
The problem for the lay surfer is that when you get up in the morning, what is that first impulse of yours? Where do you want to go? And unless you can give people a very clear use case, unless I can plant in your head the thought that I have to go to Yahoo this morning because XYZ, if it is just news, you're going to say, yeah, you might as well go to Yahoo or to Hindustan Times or Times of India, wherever it is. The news is the news. So there is no particular reason for you to come to my website. So then we started Originals, which was long-form reporting, people going into the ground, reporting the stories that were not even headlines. Like, for instance, I had Aarti Kumar Rao walking along the Brahmaputra telling stories. And Originals, if you remember, won a whole slew of awards in Reading the year that we launched.
Yeah.
So now our USP was, besides giving you the news and entertainment options and all of that, we gave you one very well-researched, reported, edited story every single working day.
And that busts various myths that we commonly have, right? That, oh, people's attention span is now very short, so they're going to, you know, log out of a YouTube video in 90 seconds or something else. And that might be true for a majority of their content, but that doesn't mean that people will not spend 30 minutes watching something or reading 3,000 words when the words are compelling enough.
Yeah, you use the right word, myth. None of this is based on any actual evidence. Look, if the story is bad, you're going to lose the person in the first 10 seconds.
Right.
If the story is good, if it is well written, if it flows seamlessly, if it is compelling enough, you are going to read to the end. Otherwise, you know, magazines like the New Yorker and Esquire and all that would have died out ages ago if this was true. It hasn't. They're actually doing well. And all the legacy media sites like the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Guardian, you name it, they're all actually investing more and more on long-form content. So clearly, we are making this up to suit ourselves. We don't want to do deep reports. And therefore, we say, oh, people's attention span, you know, give them bullet points. Look, the classic example is this BuzzFeed originated to take advantage of people's small attention spans, right?
Right.
But some 4 or 5 years ago, they pivoted. 70% of their resources are now in the long form to the extent that they actually qualify for and get nominated for Pulitzers.
Yeah.
So, yeah, your myth is telling you something and reality is telling you something else altogether. And frankly, I think it is editorial teams using it as an excuse to not do something they don't want to do or don't have the resources to do. Because putting out a long-form narrative every single day, it takes an intense amount of hard work. I mean, Nisha, Susan, and Gaurav Jain, where we three worked as a team on the Originals thing. And I remember Nisha telling me midway through that, you know, when we talked about this idea and said, let's do this, if I had known what it involved in terms of work, I'd never have done it. Because if you want a story today, you have to have at least one backup because a story can fall through at the last minute or a key interview doesn't come through. Something or the other happens.
Right.
So you're constantly juggling about 10 stories every single week to make sure that you have 5 stories every single week. That is reaching out, briefing reporters. And these are long reported pieces in some of which people have actually spent a week, 10 days in the field.
Right.
So, yeah, it's crazy, but you do it, it has its rewards.
Thank you, Prem. Let's take a short break and come back and talk about how traditional media houses in India have taken to online journalism and how you would imagine an online news house in 2020. Dear listeners, if you want to listen to more about all the troubles Indian media is facing today, especially post-COVID, please check out the BIC Talks podcast that I help produce and I sometimes host. On episode 12 of BIC Talks, journalist Krishna Prasad, formerly editor and editor-in-chief of Outlook magazine, gives us a tour de force on the Indian media business and how all of it is failing. Mr. Krishna Prasad is also on this week's episode 65 of the Teleharate Kannada podcast to talk about the woes of Kannada and the language print media. Don't miss it if you know Swalpa Kannada. Prem, then I want to just cut to our legacy media, right?
Mm-hmm.
You can talk about legacy places from TV and others now. I mean, there is a blend of all that media as well. How have you seen Indian media sort of respond to the internet? Prem, do you see true digital journalism happening in India at all?
I know this sounds kind of rude and you don't want to generalize, but the short answer is no. What we still have is stories that still follow the print template. Lots of words with maybe an image stuck here and there as a sort of nod to multimedia and maybe a small video stuck in there somewhere and put out saying this is multimedia journalism or digital journalism. It isn't. Look, back when the internet was first launched, I remember Ajit Balakrishnan, when he was trying to explain the advantages, he told us this. He said, look, radio deals with voice, television deals with moving images and some words and maybe the occasional graphic, and print obviously deals with text and images and maybe static graphs. He said the advantage of the internet, and that's what you need to leverage to the maximum, is that you can combine all these forms as appropriate, right? Where do you see that happening? For instance, if somebody is talking, is it necessarily big chunks of quotes that are the best way to represent it, or is it a small video clip of the person talking?
Right.
A data visualization. Data visualization on the internet is not a static chart. It is an interactive chart. And there was a brief golden age, for instance, when Bobby Ghosh was heading up Hindustan Times, and he did some very, very good interactive data visualizations. Then Bobby jumped or was pushed, and that was the end of that, pretty much. We're still using that old grammar. I'll give you an example. For instance, every day now I see some migrant photos, right? It's either this lady dragging a suitcase on which her son was sleeping, or there was that absolutely devastating image of a young girl wearing a tattered hat, looking into the camera, and you can see the tears flowing down her eyes. These are all absolutely compelling visuals, but they are standalone visuals.
Right.
Now, if I was engineering that same thing for a digital media site, to give you a small example, there is a tool called ThingLink, ThingLink.
Okay.
What it allows you to do is make the photograph itself interactive. So what I can do, for instance, is I can put a GPS marker and a map to show you exactly where that kid is at that point in time.
Okay.
I can show you the path the kid took from wherever and the direction the kid is going to reach wherever it is that she is headed to. I can embed a small voice clip of that kid talking to you and saying what it's like. Another example, for instance, Barkha Dutt has been doing a fabulous job of, from the time the lockdown started, she's been on the road nonstop. I think she's done some 8,000 kilometers so far, traversed 6 states, is now in Maharashtra, having started out in Delhi. And every day there are these lovely little video stories. There's the story of somebody who's running a feeding station for migrants, or she's walking along with migrants. These are all individual video clips, and you look at them and they are compelling. But where is the narrative arc? What the internet allows you to do is create narratives. For instance, suppose you used StoryMap.
Okay.
And suppose you, in real time, tracked using your GPS, you tracked where you were going. So you could now, if I go to that StoryMap, I can see where she started out from and the entire path that she took. Hmm. And at each stage, she could embed the videos in there. Now, suddenly, all these videos have come together as a long narrative.
So currently, whatever narrative is constrained by the limits of Twitter or some social media, right? And all the noise that comes with that social media.
No, my point is, look, I'm not dissing social media. In fact, I love social media. I think it's a great alternate distribution platform. But my point is, when you're thinking of a story, you have to think in terms of how can I give added life to the story. A static video is a static video. You see it and you're done.
Right.
But what if you could make that static video part of a larger ongoing narrative? Then you're taking your reader or your viewer along on an extended journey that is still continuing.
Right.
So I want to come back tomorrow to see how far Barkha has gone along that road and what else she's seen. I can go back in time to see what she saw in Delhi or what she saw in UP. So suddenly your old copy or your old stories have also got renewed shelf life.
Right.
These are some of the, and these are very basic, but these are some of the things that really go into what we call digital journalism on the internet. The ability to weave stories in ways that could not be imagined earlier. And we're just not taking advantage of that at all.
So in that sense, this is sort of sustained reportage in journalism as opposed to long form, right? So this is sustained. So you do it in chunks, but you fit it into something much larger.
And the ability to fit it into something much larger is one of the big advantages of the internet.
Right.
For instance, I mean, if you have migrants walking, what kind of terrain are they walking through? Mm-hmm. You can map that terrain very easily on your Google view, right? Street view or topography view. And you can embed that in the picture of the migrant. So now suddenly I'm actually, as a user, I'm seeing this picture and I'm playing around with it. I'm looking at the topography. I'm looking at the distance that she's covered and the path that she's taken. I'm looking at how much further she has to go and what kind of terrain she's going to go through.
Yeah.
I'm hearing her voice. All of that is suddenly a static image gets life. That's what the internet can do for you. And these are very vestigial examples. Look, this might smack of showing off a little bit. Frankly, I don't care. If you go to peeply.org.
And I have.
There is far better multimedia journalism there, which was done in 2014, 2015, than legacy media sites are doing today in 2020.
Right.
And we did it with no investment. There was 4 of us, Kalyan, Verma, Arti Kumar Rao, Rahul Bhatia, and I. We funded the thing out of our own pockets. The site was not, you know, we didn't have a team of MIT engineers designing the site. It was a WordPress hack.
Right.
It's not that it can't be done. And the nice thing is, I did start out by saying there is no sign of digital journalism in India. That's not exactly true. There are good signs, but they're coming from individuals.
Okay.
For instance, not long after podcasts became a thing in the West, Amit Verma started the scene in the unseen. It's a classic now.
Yeah.
It's a huge resource. More recently, the data journalist Rukmini, she started doing these 5-minute podcasts every day on COVID-19. It's become a go-to resource for me. Every day I look for the latest iteration because she breaks it up into questions that are relevant to that day and that time and where we are in the national conversation. And she gives it to you in 5 minutes.
This is the moving curve.
Correct. Then there are these specialist sites, for instance, IndiaSpend, which is doing deep data dives. That, again, is one of the advantages. Then there are the genre sites, lawyers, for instance, coming together as a collective to explain points of law and what's happening in the courts and stuff like that. I remember this newsletter, which ended its lifespan about a month or so ago, called Broadsheet. It was a brilliant example of aggregation. It was on par with the best in the world. The thing is, we have talent to burn. We've got brilliant young journalists, but the institution itself does not have either the will or the inclination to take storytelling on the internet to the state-of-the-art levels is probably where I would leave this.
Okay. I think we can probably spend an entire hour talking about everything that's wrong with the print media and everything that's broken. Right? But instead, if I just cut to the real meat of the question, if you were to start this like with these examples that you say are scratching the surface of how you can genuinely do compelling journalism in this digital age, in 2020, with the lockdown sort of unwinding at its own pace, how would you reimagine digital journalism in India? If you were to start a house, what would that be like?
I think my starting point would be this. The single biggest issue you have today is trust, or the lack of trust. So from the get-go, I want to address that issue. And you address that by saying that whatever you're doing on the internet, it would be facts first, followed by the explanation, then the analysis, then the opinion. And opinion never merges with facts.
Okay.
You can say that Nirmala Sitharaman announced a package yesterday, but you cannot in your news report say she announced a superb package that will address the woes of the migrants and stuff like that. That's opinion.
Right.
Now, what the reader wants first is the facts. Then explain the background to some of these facts. If, for instance, you're talking of portable ration cards, what does that mean? What is the backstory? Analyze the thing, and these layer one onto the other. That is number one. That's the way you regain trust.
And do you think that's still possible in this hyper-partisan space where just laying down the facts is uncomfortable for some people or many people?
Pawan, it's classic thing. You put a pizza in front of me, and do I want a small slice of it, a partisan slice that is this particular audience, or do I want the whole pizza? I want everybody to read my site.
Right.
So why am I playing to a particular gallery when I have the whole world to play to? I just don't get it. If scale is the point, then the sharper your slice, the tighter the audience group that you're playing to, the less chance you have of growing, right? Ultimately, you just end up speaking to a small minority.
Unfortunately, the easy solution to growth is seen as pandering, right?
Yeah, but you pander and pretty much you run out of the people who want your pandering. That's my point.
Right.
There are sites that market themselves as being on the left side of the spectrum. And fine, people from the left will go, but not everybody from the left will go anyway.
Right.
And similarly with the right. Say an Arnab makes no bones about the fact that he's talking to this hyper-patriotic whatever group. But how many of them are there? It's a country of 1.3 billion. Why the hell are you shutting out a billion of those?
And eventually there are diminishing returns.
Exactly. So that is the first one. It is the trust issue. And along with that, accept the fact that news sites should be for everyone and not just for those who agree with my editorial point of view. Secondly, it is about clarity about what I'm aiming for. I'm not interested in putting resources, for instance, into non-monetizable metrics like PVs and UUs, which is to say, the content that I'm putting up will not be towards generating these things. These are interesting to know how my site is functioning, but these are not goals. They are the tools you use to sort of determine your state of health. Unfortunately, what is happening is that now media houses are being driven by the Excel sheet, which it shouldn't be. And think about this. If you're generating PVs and if you make that your KRA.
Sorry, PV. Page view. Yes.
Right. If that is your metric and you're putting most of your resources into increasing your page views and everybody else is doing the same thing, you reach that classic economic conundrum, right? You're producing more than there is demand for.
Right.
What happens? The price of PVs, the CPM, the cost per million PVs, falls.
Right.
So you're actually working against your best interest. The next step of that is, if I'm engineering the site, I'm engineering it for tomorrow. We spoke about this earlier, that the life cycle of the internet, development on the internet is incredibly rapid, right?
Right.
A print, for instance, was static when you had facsimile printing coming up, and that was the last big thing that happened in print. So what happens is, once you've wrapped your head around what is possible in print, you've got a template and you can just go in every day and work to that template. The problem with the internet is, you have something today, you know what the engagement areas are, you know how digital journalism can work and all of that. And there is some kid sitting somewhere, I swear he's making something that will probably launch tomorrow and it will change the entire paradigm.
True.
So you need a highly flexible, highly agile site. If something launches tomorrow and there is potential, it needs to be folded into your editorial matrix the day after.
Okay.
At the latest. Then it is mobile first. Every statistic is telling you that increasingly consumption is on mobile, but your design is for the laptop,
right,
or the desktop, right, whatever. It doesn't work. So that and the story page as the homepage, both of them go together, because on mobile, again, you're consuming links. Links take you to individual stories. Your choice is either the reader reads the story and then shuts the browser, or he goes deeper into your site, and you want him to go deeper into your site. You want him to discover more and more. Stories are best told through multimedia. If there is somebody speaking, let that person speak. You don't put chunks of quotes. I'd rather hear that person's voice, and it's easy embedding an audio or a video.
Right.
So there is that.
And allowing at the same time for people to watch something on mute, right? Because that's also something that we do a lot on our cell phones.
Absolutely. So every single thing, the reader has to have the ultimate control. And I was just getting to that. Stories can be interactive. For instance, I don't know if you know of a tool called Hypotheses, which I use a lot.
Okay.
It is actually Hypotheses with a dot between the S. So it is Hypothesis. .is.
Okay.
Now, what it is it gives you a little button on the toolbar. So suppose you're on a page, you can click that button. And now if you highlight a section of text, you can write a comment.
Okay.
Or you can argue with that particular premise or whatever.
Right.
And you can share your annotated version of that same story with your peer group.
Okay.
Or with the world at large through Twitter or Facebook or whatever. Now what happens is, I not only see the story, I see an informed reader annotating that and saying, this is bloody stupid.
Right.
And I have a view about that, and I get into that conversation. See, suddenly a story gets a heartbeat, and the heartbeat is the reader, what the reader does with it. So
social media still seems like broadcast and distribution and engagement that leads out of the site, but it's, you still need that web property, which is still standing on its own, right?
Well, call it a web property, call it an app. It doesn't really matter which one you choose. If you're going mobile first, you might as well go app with maybe a web interface for those who... Look, the fact that we're going mobile first, or the fact that increasingly people are moving to mobile, doesn't mean that the era of the desktop is over. It is just that
right.
It is now secondary. So if you engineer for the best use case and make sure that responsive design is now almost automatic. Yeah, press of a button, if you really want to think about it that way. So it's not some big engineering problem that you have to crack. It's already been cracked. There's no reason why you shouldn't do it. The reason why I said mobile first is, you think in terms of not just the fact that the reader is consuming it on mobile, but you look at the form factor and say, how do you make it possible for him to consume it seamlessly on mobile? For instance, you don't have 350-word paragraph, because on a small screen, that's two scrolls. So little things like that, make it easy for the reader, make it possible for him to consume easily, make it possible for him to discover easily, make it possible for him to interact with the story. And that's pretty much what the template of the site would be. And there is one final element to it, which is, you have to realize that the traditional forms of advertising are dead. There is no such thing as your banner ad, a really valuable banner ad anymore. You have websites, for instance, where you click on a story link, and the first thing that happens is, from right to left, one huge ad comes and covers the entire copy. Then you have to find a way of shoving it out of your face. And you start reading, and then suddenly you hear some voice, and you're like, what the hell is this? And you look down, and on the right corner, there is an autoplay video. Now, all of this is very cynical. You're doing this simply in order to tell the advertiser that so many people saw your ad. But here's the thing. Every single day I see that ad, because it's on a website that I go to fairly often. this one that traverses from right to left and covers the entire screen. And every single day I push it back. And just now when I was thinking about it, after you asked that question of what's your website like, I thought about this and I realized I don't know what that ad is. And I've easily been seeing it for 6 months at least.
Right. And you've been seeing it as an annoyance. You just want it out of your way, right?
Exactly. So my point is, realize that these things... Now, the reason that I'm pushing this thing off, the reason that I don't know what this ad is about, it should tell you that these things are not working. And sooner or later, the advertiser who's putting money into this is also going to catch on that it's not working. So you have to rethink revenue models. And you have to think of it in two ways. One is, don't put all your eggs in one basket. You've already discovered the problem with that, right?
Right.
There is a lockdown. There is nobody needs to advertise anything at this point in time. I mean, barring the government, which uses advertisements as a bribe and as a stick.
Right.
There's no manufacturing. There are no new products being launched. Advertising has just plummeted. That basically means that your websites are handicapped. You don't know where the next rupee is coming from. You need to have multiple streams of revenue. And the one other thing is a fundamental change is that it is largely about sponsorships. It's not about advertising. It's about working with brands and not working for brands, which is what I'm doing if I just put an ad on the page. I'll give you an example, for instance. I notice a lot of sites now have these very dedicated cuisine pages, recipes and all of that. It's either a video or text or combination of both or whatever. The problem is these pages start with a lot of blah about, you know, I remember as a kid, my grandmother was making the dish and blah, 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 and there's a story and then there's a recipe. And then what? How are you making money out of this? Except for readership and PVs and stuff.
Right.
Now, here's a way of looking at it. Suppose, I mean, you tell your story, do whatever the hell you want, or just have a recipe. The recipe is for two people. And so the ingredients are calibrated for two people. Now, I read the recipe and I decide that this is something I want to make for the party that I'm having this Saturday. And there are six people coming. This page should be engineered in such a way that I can go to that point and just change two to six in the number of people to be served.
Right.
And everything else readjusts. Hmm. And then I click a button. It takes me directly to, say, an Amazon pantry or a Nature's Basket, whoever I'm working with. And these ingredients pop up into my shopping cart. I click a button. I paid for it. It is delivered at the time that I want it for my cooking. Now you've gone the last mile. You engineer this and then go to an Amazon pantry or a thing and say, okay, this is what we have. We can either do revenue share or you can sponsor the thing and take all the money. Now what I've got is I'm not stuck with every quarter wondering who, if anybody, will advertise on my site. If I do this across sectors, I know an annual income is coming and that helps me plan for the next year and the year after that.
Right. And this is something like not this interactive. I've only seen something even close to this happen on YouTube with, you know, big US or global YouTubers, because again, they're individuals who are trying to build a brand and do something, right? And when, at least with a lot of credible people on YouTube, what I've seen is when somebody tries to include an ad within that video, it's always compelling, it's always relevant, it's always sort of linked to what you're watching, and you don't feel offended that the ad exists.
Absolutely.
You may not want to go buy it because it may not be relevant for you at that point, but the base level that the ad is not offensive itself is something that we are not meeting a lot of the time with online advertisement.
Yeah, and also that gratification is baked in. I mean, look at all the tutorial ads on YouTube, right? Whether it's a photography tutorial or editing tutorial or whatever it is.
Right.
You'll find that they talk about various tools and technologies and stuff in the course of the tutorial. And there is this little slider that says, I have linked to all of these in the comments below.
Yeah, right.
And so if you like a particular tool and this guy is explaining what he does with the tool and you're like, that's what I was looking for. I go down there, I click on it and I have to buy something. It takes me straight to the shop. Now he's getting a cut of the proceeds.
Right.
My point is advertising increasingly needs to bake in gratification. That's where the money is coming from or will come from. Your static ads will not work. It's dead. It's just that we haven't really taken its pulse and figured out it's dead and entered the damn thing. So yeah, that would probably be the various points that I would keep in mind if I was designing, creating, or redesigning an existing site today.
So Prem, a couple of closing questions. One, do you think Indians are willing to pay for good news? I think it's like being addicted to sugar, right? We've been addicted to these 5 rupee broadsheets that land up on our doorstep. And if I'm not mistaken, in even just Indian rupee terms, we pay less for print journalism than even Pakistan, where the cost of a newspaper is higher. So Is it possible, you think, to reverse that and also get a lot of subscription-driven or patron-driven journalism to complement these other streams of revenue?
Yeah, absolutely. Which is why I said there have to be multiple revenue streams. This is one of them. And I think, look, let's not brush off all Indians as saying that we are all freeloaders. I think Indians will pay for quality. Here's the thing, right? I remember reading recently something about the New York Times massive spike in subscribers. And somewhere in there was a small mention that a good chunk of it is actually coming from India.
Okay.
It's not the big chunk, but there are significant numbers coming from India. I mean, the New York Times does have a lot of Indian subscribers. Now, think about it. Why in the hell is somebody sitting in India actually subscribing? And I'm not talking of Indian Americans and you know, an Indian sitting here is willing to subscribe to a New Yorker, to a New York Times, to a Washington Post, to an Atlantic. It should tell you something. It should tell you that you're prepared to pay for value.
And that also puts a nice ceiling, right? If somebody feels compelled enough to pay something for the New York Times, it also gives us a sense of what people might be willing to pay for other things.
Exactly. And let's not put it on the subscriber. Let's put it on ourselves and say, if we are not creating value that makes you take out your credit card or your, you know, Google Pay or whatever it is you're using, then the fault is with us. It's not with the Indian who will not take anything that is not given for free. Another example is Indians are willing to support good work. For instance, I remember when Peoply was reaching its close-by date, all four of us actually have had people reaching out saying, look, I mean, why the hell is this not continuing and can we help and we're willing to support and stuff like that. The thing is that Peoply is highly resource intensive. At that point in time, we had certain doubts and certain thing, but my belief is you show proof of concept, people will put down money if it is valuable enough.
Right.
And there are sites like Ken and all that are actually making it work, right?
Yeah, it's not like it's the bureaucratic idea, right? That, you know, you want to do something new and somebody asks you, okay, show me a precedent. Well, I mean, that's a bad way to do it. But the reality now is that there are precedents even in India that seem to be working.
Yeah, that is one part of it. And the other part of it is that if you're going to put anodyne stuff behind a paywall, it's not going to work. And then you use that as proof that Indians will not pay. That's illogical. Nobody's going to pay for, you know, rubbish that you can find elsewhere. So, for instance, nobody's going to pay for news for the simple reason that news is available everywhere. All I have to do is follow one of the agencies here. Why do I even need a media site? So think of what you're putting a price to. Think of whether it is worth it for the reader, the user, and use hybrid models. For instance, in television, when you have running commentary of sports, in between every over, there is a small ad. Now, it becomes intrusive only if you cut the action and, you know, the ad intrudes either into the end of the previous action or the beginning of the next one, right?
Right.
But if the ad is right in the middle and it's trimmed for size, you don't really mind. You're like, okay, so why are you not doing that on online comment? Why is there not a little call to action from a brand or something popping up after every six balls or something online? There are so many ways of thinking of revenue. You're just stuck with this thing of let's sell a lot of page views.
And if we just start with the proposition that let these ads not be offensive, I think that can be exactly enough of a scalpel to get rid of things that will drive away readers.
Yeah.
So Prem, final question.
Right.
So to start something like this or to revamp something like this, what would be a rough ballpark pot of money that one would need, investment that one would need before, you know, you get all this going?
Well, there's some things that I'm not going to quantify. For instance, things like the hard stuff, which is working space and, you know, all of that.
And that's also very subjective on what beast you want to make.
Exactly.
Right? And what entity that you want to have.
Exactly. Given the recent experiences, I would actually think in terms of limited working space, a lot of work happening from individual homes and stuff. So those things are debatable. And it also depends on which city you're basing in. And there's a whole lot of ifs and buts. But purely from a content perspective, I would imagine you're talking of something like about 100 crore in 4 years, with the goal that at the end of 4 years, you are self-sufficient, you are revenue neutral.
Right.
And just to put that in context, I know of a legacy media site that at some point decided to go digital first. And their idea of going digital first was they re-engineered their newsroom into what they called a hub and spoke arrangement. And they spent something like 80 crore on it. Yeah, this is office space design. You're happy to spend 80 crore because that is something you can see, right?
Yeah, but 80 crore is still an absurd number for any such thing, right?
It's an absurd number if you're talking of interior decoration. It's not an absurd number if you're talking of a high-quality website.
Certainly.
It's ballpark, and that's about all it takes, yeah. 3 years to 4 years, about 100 crore, a max 120 crore. Obviously, it's not, that doesn't mean 40 crore every year. The first year, there is more investment, and then because it's starting up.
Right.
And then it reduces. So you plan it in such a way that the first year, there is startup, there is teething troubles, and then there is audience acquisition. By the middle of the second year, you are looking in terms of introducing various revenue models. By the third year, you're making that whole thing robust. And by year four, you're looking at, let's at least earn the money we are spending. And then it is like, how do you escalate that and get back some of your initial investment? If you're thinking VC and 10x investment, it's not going to happen.
Right.
Media does not do that for you. But if you're looking at creating something which will in time pay for itself, yeah, there's a good time to do it simply because, like you said, all your media houses are under pressure. Audience is dropping off and therefore, there's this vicious cycle that's happening. Audiences are dropping off. Advertising is dropping off. Therefore, you are laying off people and you're laying off senior people, which means you're laying off, you're kicking out experience. And that tells on quality. And that diminishing in quality then leads to more readers leaving you and the cycle perpetuates itself.
Yeah. And what we get is a market of lemons.
Yeah, exactly. Without the option of making lemonade out of it. So.
On that note, Prem, thank you so much for joining me on the Pragati podcast. To me, our episode is optimistic. While we can despair endlessly about the state of the media, to think that it just takes maybe less than 100 crores to get this reversed. That's nothing. That's peanuts for the size of the economy and the size of the country that we have.
Yeah, well, if you know somebody who has peanuts, let me know.
If I know, I'll see how to use some of those peanuts myself too. But Prem, thank you so much for joining me.
Total pleasure. You take care.
You too. Thank you for staying with us till the end. If you have any questions or comments, do write in to podcast@thinkpragati.com. And hey, if you like the podcast and listen to us on iTunes or Apple Podcasts, please leave us a rating and a review. It'll mean a lot to us. The Pragati podcast is available on the IVM podcast app and pretty much every other podcast app and platform. We are there everywhere.